So I'm going to tell you about some measurements of the Casimir force on nanostructured corrugated surfaces. So far, almost all the experiments on Casimir force is for smooth surfaces, such as between two plates, two smooth plates. And what I measure is on a structure with nanoscale trenches like this one. And we see deviations from the pairwise additive approximation for the Casimir force. So first of all, I'm going to tell you about the micromechanical oscillator for measuring the Casimir force. So I developed this when I was a postdoc with Federico Capasso, and now this technique is being used in a couple of groups to measure the Casimir force. I'll show you the nonlinear effects of the Casimir force on the oscillatory motion of a macroscopic oscillator. And I'll mention the geometry dependence of the Casimir force. And our experiment is on a very strongly deformed surface, an array of nanoscale trenches like this one. And we see up to 30% deviation from the pairwise additive approximation. And it is clearly evidence of the geometry dependence of the Casimir force. However, it is a factor of 2 smaller than the theory on perfect metals by Thorsten Emick. And this one possibility is that the structure has a finite conductivity. So it's an interplay between geometry and finite conductivity effects. So I'm just going to give a very brief introduction to the Casimir force. It's the attractive force between two electrically neutral conducting surfaces, and it arises from the zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic field. So the simple picture is that for an electromagnetic mode with frequency omega, the electric and magnetic field oscillates, and in the quantum description, the energy is n plus a half h bar omega. So even when there's no photon in the field, there's a finite zero-point energy, 1 half h bar omega. And this zero-point energy arises because of the uncertainty principle, because the electric and magnetic field fluctuate. They cannot be exactly zero. So now, instead of free space, if we consider a cavity formed by two perfectly conducting surfaces, the conducting surfaces will impose boundary conditions of the electromagnetic field so that only an integer of half wavelength can fit inside this cavity. So it turns out that the energy, the zero-point energy in this cavity is different from the case when the plates are not there. So and this leads to the Casimir force of attraction between the two surfaces. So the Casimir force is associated with modification of the boundary condition on the electromagnetic field. So this is the Casimir force on two perfectly conducting surfaces. Notice that there's only h bar and c in the formula. There's no electron charge or mass. So this force is extremely small at large separations. For example, if we have two silicon plates that are 2 microns thick, and they are separated by 1 micrometer, and the Casimir force in that case is comparable to the gravitational attraction between the two surfaces. However, the force increases very rapidly with decreasing distance. It goes like 1 over d to the 4th power. So if we go from d from 1 micron to 10 nanometer, a factor of 100 change, according to this formula, the Casimir force will be 8 orders of magnitude larger. And at that kind of separation, the Casimir force is comparable to an atmosphere of pressure pushing the two plates together. Another thing I want to point out is that the simple picture that I just described is really an idealized case for two metal plates that reflects light perfectly at all frequencies. And in reality, all metals become transparent if the frequency is high enough. So recently, there's a lot of work on various corrections to the Casimir force, including the finite conductivity correction, surface roughness, and the finite temperature correction to the Casimir force is one of the very intense subject of intense debate recently. And in particular, I am going to show you about the geometry effects. Okay, so even though Casimir predicted this force more than 50 years ago, accurate experiments start to appear about 10 years ago. So and over time, these experiments become more and more accurate. But in most of these experiments, one of these surfaces is chosen to be a sphere. Okay, the reason is that the Casimir force depends very strongly on distance. It's very difficult to keep two plates exactly parallel as small separations. By using a spherical object, there's only one place of closest approach, so one can eliminate the alignment problem. It does change the distance dependence of the Casimir force. Instead of a 1 over d fourth dependence, now it becomes a 1 over d cubed dependence for this geometry. And the 1 over d cubed dependence is obtained using something called the proximity force approximation. Okay? Essentially, it's saying that the local force between two points can be approximated by treating it as a parallel plate. Okay? So this is valid if the distance d is much smaller than the radius of the sphere. So the curvature is very small. And typically in experiments, the distance between the two surfaces is on the order of 100 to 400 nanometer, and R is about 50 to 100 micrometer. So in this case, the proximity force approximation is valid. But I'll show you later in my talk that if we have a very strongly deformed geometry instead of a smooth surface like this, the proximity force approximation can break down. Okay, so this is the micromechanical torsion device that you might have seen before. So the plate you see in the middle is a polysilicon plate. The plate is suspended here and here by two torsional rods. So this picture zoom in at one of the torsional rod, and you can see that the plate attached to one side of the torsional rod and the other end attached to the substrate. So the plate is able to rotate about this axis of the torsional rod. And this shows you a cross section. Okay, this is the top plate. And the plate can rotate about this axis. So this plate is going to be one of the surfaces to confine the electromagnetic mode in the case of the Casimir force. The other surface to confine the electromagnetic mode will be an external object that we place close to one side of this movable plate. The size of the plate varies from 200 micron to about 500 micrometer in this case. And the rod is about 1.2 times 2 microns in cross-section. Now, for detecting rotation of the top plate, there are two electrodes underneath it, one on each side of the torsional rod. You can see the electrodes here and here. So essentially, when there's no torque on the plate, the capacitance of this plate to the two electrodes are the same. And if there's an external torque that tilts the top plate, one of the capacitance decrease and the other one increase. And that leads to an imbalance of capacitance that we can infer the torque on the top plate.
So yep. What is the structure on the surface of the plate?
These holes?
Yeah.
Okay, the reason they're holes is because, remember the size is 500 micron. The gap between them is 2 micrometer. And the gap essentially is the gap is created by etching away a sacrificial oxide layer. So remember, imagine that the plate is fabricated by putting silicon here, and then putting a silicon oxide layer underneath we call it a sacrificial layer, because the whole purpose of that layer is to create a gap, so that after you remove it, the plate can move. And the reason we need these holes is that the size of the plate is 500 by 500. The gap at the side is only 2 micrometer. So it's very difficult for the solvent, in this case the hydrofluoric acid, to get underneath. So here, by putting the holes here, the acid can actually go through this hole to the middle parts of the plate. So if these holes are absent, it will be very difficult to eliminate the oxide at the center.
You say you guarantee that the oxide layer is completely eliminated.
It's completely eliminated, yes. Okay, so this shows you the operation of the device. I apply a DC voltage to one of the electrodes to electrostatically attract and tilt the top plate, as here. And we use the other electrode to measure the capacitance. Okay. So as the top plate tilts towards this electrode, the capacitance decreases because this plate is moving away. And as the voltage increases, the capacitance decreases until at this point that the plate tilts so much that it steps down to the electrode. If we keep increasing the voltage, the capacitance remains unchanged because the plate cannot tilt any further. And if we sweep the voltage back down, you see that the plate remains stuck to the electrode. the restoring torque from the spring is not sufficient to pull it back up. And in this case, it is called a cross section. So this plot shows you the operation and also the malfunctioning of the device. Okay, so this section is actually a very important problem in micromechanical systems. That's why there are a lot of interest in the possibility of changing the sign of the Casimir force to make it a repulsive force so that when surfaces come together, they will bounce back. Right? So I'll comment more about that later. Okay, this is the experimental setup. Let's focus on the schematic first. We put the oscillator on a piezoelectric stage, and we put a sphere that's coated with gold close to one side of the oscillator. As the piezo extends, it changes the distance d, and we essentially just measure the force as a function of distance. So there are a lot of experimental details that I won't go into, but there are two important procedures that must be done in all Casimir force measurements. So for example, in Steve Larenrock's, the first experiment, it was a huge pendulum. And in Mohidian's group, they use a AFM cantilever. But in no matter what the system people use, there are two procedures that must be done. Okay, the first is the calibration by the electrostatic force. So in this case, we apply a voltage to one of the surfaces and apply a voltage between the two surfaces to set up an electrostatic, deliberately set up an electrostatic attraction between them. And for this geometry, a sphere and a plate, the force is given by this very simple formula. It's proportional to the voltage difference, square, and inversely proportional to the distance. So the blue dots here is the measured electrostatic force, and the red line is the fit using the electrostatic formula. From the, remember that's a piezoelectric stage underneath the device, and that can produce very accurate and reproducible relative displacement. Okay. So from this point to the last point on my data, I know that I've changed the distance by 2 microns. What it does not tell me is the distance here, okay, the distance of closest approach. And this distance of closest approach is determined entirely from the fit to the electrostatic force. So naturally, the next step is to turn the voltage to zero and repeat the measurement of the force as a function of distance. And before we can do that, there's the second important step of balancing the...
For this, yeah. You assume that the surfaces are perfectly flat, right?
That's correct.
Otherwise, the electrostatic force would be different.
That's correct. That's correct. So that will affect how far you want to fit it. So if you go very far to almost touching, there will be a lot of corrections. But if you in my typical experiment, we stop so that the corrections are still small. Yeah. But you kind of lose on the sensitivity. Obviously, if you go much closer, you can estimate this distance much better. But you, on the other hand, you have more corrections. So it's kind of a compromise.
What is the temperature?
These are all done at room temperatures. So far, I think all Casimir force measurements, all of them are at room temperature. Okay, so the second important thing is to balance the residual voltage. So if we look back in this formula, we see that the voltage is depends on V to the square. Okay? So here what I try to do is I stay at a fixed distance D and try to get this V square dependence. And indeed I get a pretty nice parabola. Okay? The only problem is that this parabola is not centered exactly at zero. Okay? So this residual voltage is somewhat expected if we measure the force between two different metal because the work function can be different. In this case we are using gold for both surfaces. And we find that the residual voltage is about 20 millivolt. And in this case, it's most likely due to slight differences in the preparation of the surfaces. So when we measure the Casimir force, we actually need to go to this voltage where the parabola is the minimum so that we eliminate the electrostatic contribution. So this shows you the variation of the residual voltage as a function of distance. So when the sphere is far away from the surface, it interacts with a large area of the surface and it sees some average work function. And if a sphere is very close to the surface, it's only sensitive to the local work function. So if the local work function is different from the average value, that will result in a shift in the minimum of the parabola along the voltage axis. So here you can see that as long as as I change the distance, you can see that the parabola becomes narrower as we expect, and they are also centered at approximately the same point. Okay, so the residual voltage doesn't change a lot, and when we go to very small distance, the entire parabola goes up. So here you can see that the force that we are talking about consists of two components: the electrostatic component, which depends on distance and scales like v square. And the component due to the Casimir force, which depends on distance but is independent of voltage. And it is this independent with voltage part that we identify with the Casimir force. And also, if you look very closely, the minimum of the parabola is actually not exactly constant. Okay? In this case, I think they shift by a few millivolts. So if one is doing a very accurate measurement of the Casimir force, one will need to keep track of how the parabolas shift as you increase the distance.
How do you get an intuition what's a big shift, what's not a big shift? If you tell me a number like
that,
it sounds small. I'm supposed to say, wow, that's big. How do I get an intuition?
Well, okay, you can imagine that you can shift this parabola so that it kind of offset from the other one, right? So that is when the electrostatic force is definitely kicking in. So you can estimate from the shift how much residual electrostatic force is remaining.
Are you saying that the shift tells you how far along to move your finger along the parabola to see how much of a force?
Well, if you want to,
you're making, is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is
an intuition of what's big and small.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that some earlier experiments, okay, including this one that I did early, what I did was I just go to this voltage, I keep the voltage fixed, and I change the distance. Okay, but that will work if all the parabolas are perfectly aligned. If they are not perfectly aligned, then you don't go along this direction. You have to follow the minimum.
I take your point. I thought that was the idea, but in terms of the actual force measurement, how do we get an idea what that shift turns into? We move our finger left or right on that curve and see that now we move our finger up to follow the curve. Is the error that's consequent to having the minimum shift?
You can estimate the residual electrostatic force this way, so that you can only locate it up to maybe like 1 or 2 millivolts.
The up down that goes with the left right shift is a good idea of how much error there is.
Yeah, that's right. So let's say we are off by that much.
Right. So if it's getting sharp, that's exactly where it's going to be a bigger consequence.
It's a bigger, no, actually, the other way. Because as it's going sharp, the Casimir part is actually very big. As you are down here, it's very flat. But the fact is that the quantity that you want to measure is also very small. So actually, it is.
And in that sense, right.
Yeah, so it's actually more important at larger distance.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
If you go to small distance, actually the fractional correction is actually very small. Okay, so in order to compare the theory, it's necessary to take into the finite conductivity of the gold surface. And in this case, the first calculation was done by Lipschitz. And basically, he took into account the fluctuating electromagnetic dipole and current inside the material that is induced by the fluctuating electromagnetic field, and he solved the problem with appropriate boundary conditions. So now we have the force can be determined by the frequency dependent dielectric function. So the force is given by this rather complicated formula. But what's really important is that you need the separation C and the dielectric function along the imaginary axis. So typically what all experiments do when they compare to theory is to look up the optical property that is tabulated in the data books and then do a numerical integration using Lipschitz formula. So when we do that, and actually that's one of the corrections, and the other correction is due to the finite the roughness of the two surface. So once you take into account these two corrections, it is possible to get a reasonably good agreement of the Casimir force with theory. So here, this is force versus distance. Okay, on the right axis, I also show you the angle versus distance. So when the angle is small, the force is proportional to the angle. So in this case, you can see that the plate rotates by about 6 microradian at the smallest separation from the gold sphere. So in this case, it is an experiment to show that the quantum effects can play a role in micromechanical devices. Because so far, the operation of commercial micromechanical devices are described very well by just classical mechanics, because the separation between components is on the order of a micrometer. But as the devices become smaller and smaller in size, one might reach the regime where quantum effects like the Casimir force need to be accounted for. And our experiment, I think, is the first one to show that it is possible to have these kind of quantum effects in a micromechanical system. Okay, so apart from static effects, the Casimir force also have a strong effect on the oscillations of the device. So the previous experiment that I told you about is essentially a DC experiment measuring the tilt of the plate. But here we can also set the plate into oscillation. Okay, remember there are two electrodes underneath the top plate. Okay, we use the left electrode to excite the torsional mode of oscillation and use the right plate to detect the capacitance change. So as we apply an AC voltage here, it charges up this plate periodically, and there will be a periodic force. And as the plate oscillates, it changes the capacitance on this side.
Charge is spilling over to the right part of the plate?
Well, the plate is grounded. Yeah, so there's no net charge on it. Okay, but the charge will flow between the electrodes.
Again, how much of angular rotation?
How much angular rotation? Let's see.
The reason I asked it is that the D you indicated was a vertical distance, but of course the distance of closest approach is shifted from that. Just the vertical distance if there's an angle of rotation of the plate.
Yes. Yes, so you're saying that...
Yeah, so substantial rotation.
Right, and I think in this case the rotation... okay, let me put this in... this is not a figure that is to scale.
Multiply micro red by the arm there.
That is the distance, yeah. So if I multiply micro red by the arm there, I think it in this case it... it can oscillate by up to 10 or 20 nanometer, while here you see in the previous plot we are measuring at about 200 nanometer, 100 nanometer. So I'm going to show you the effect that actually there is a big effect. I think that's my point. Then this is what I want to show you. Actually, when the sphere is far away, then the oscillator by itself. So I show you three peaks. One of them is when the sphere is far away, okay? And this is essentially a simple harmonic oscillator peak. If we put the sphere to within 135 nanometer within the top plate, the peak actually becomes asymmetric. If we place it even closer, then hysteresis will occur. As we sweep the frequency up, it follows a red curve, and then as we sweep the frequency down, it follows the blue curve past the peak of the red curve to this point and then jumps. So the reason this occurs is because there are nonlinear terms in the Casimir force introduces nonlinear terms in the equation of motion. So this is the equation of motion of the oscillator. Okay, the inertial term, the damping term, and the restoring torque. And then we are driving it with a periodic torque. When the sphere is present, there's an additional term, okay, the torque exerted by the sphere on the plate, okay, BF, okay, D plus B theta. I think this might be what you were asking for earlier. So F could be the Casimir force, or it could be a deliberate electrostatic attraction that we apply. So if the theta is small, we Taylor expand, we do a series expansion of the force about the equilibrium position. Okay, so this is the first, second, and third spatial derivative of the force. If we plug this force into the equation of motion, then we get this overall equation. Okay. So if the oscillation amplitude is small, the force will shift the resonance frequency. And this shift in resonance frequency is proportional to the gradient of the force. And the coefficient, the nonlinear coefficients alpha and beta, are determined by the higher order derivatives of the force. So what happens is that when the sphere is far away, then we have the theta and theta cube terms can be neglected, and we get back a simple harmonic oscillator. And as the sphere approach the plate, then the Casimir force starts to, it's a very strong distance dependent. It introduces nonlinear terms in the equation of motion. The peak will shift to a different frequency because of the first gradient. And it also becomes asymmetric due to the nonlinear terms. And if the asymmetry becomes very strong, the peak will tip over like this, okay? So in a certain region of frequency, there are three possible solutions. And which solution that the oscillator takes depends on the history. If we sweep the frequency up, it will follow the lower branch until it reaches the end of the tri-stable region, and then it has to go up. And we sweep it back down, you go to the tip of the peak and then jump down. So the Casimir force measurements, some experiments use the static deflection, and some of them use actually the frequency shift. And in the case of the frequency shift, you don't measure the force, you measure the force gradient. And it is also important that you take care of these nonlinear effects. If the sphere is very far away from the oscillator, that's not a problem. If the sphere becomes very close, you can see that the nonlinear effects can actually change your peak frequency. So in addition to the shift in the frequency due to the gradient, there's also a tilt that is due to nonlinearity. So if you put the sphere very close, it is necessary to turn down the oscillation amplitude so that you're not being affected by these nonlinear phenomena. Okay, so this is this part of the talk is essentially what I did when I was at Bell Labs with Federico Capasso. And the next part of the talk, I'm going to show you a new experiment that on the geometry dependence of the Casimir force. So before we discuss the geometry dependence, let's talk about the relationship of the Casimir force to the van der Waals force. So both the Casimir force and the van der Waals force arise from quantum fluctuations. The van der Waals force is commonly understood in terms of the correlation between fluctuating dipoles. So in the simplest picture, we just think about two dipoles kind of fluctuating together. And when going back to the case of the Casimir force between plates, we have been doing the discussion in terms of the fluctuation of the electromagnetic field in the gap. But that is not the only way to look at the problem. Okay, another approach is to divide this large plate into small elements, assume that the elements interact through a van der Waals kind of interaction, and then sum them up. Okay? So in a certain situations, this approach actually works okay, provided that one takes into account the retardation effects due to the finite speed of light. And for two plates, if you do that, you can recover the spatial dependence of the force. However, this approach breaks down for other geometries, and the reason is that the Casimir force is not pairwise additive. The attraction between two objects is affected by the presence of a third one. So this is illustrated by this cartoon here. For example, we have three blocks of matter interacting through some kind of van der Waals interaction. In the left hand side, the force on the lower block is essentially the sum of the force by the two small, the small objects. But if we rearrange the objects such that the configuration between become something like this one, in this case, then the force on the lower guy will not be the sum, will no longer be the sum between the first two. So in other words, this is not valid, it's not always valid to divide a extensive body into small constituents and then sum up the force. Or in other words, the Casimir force depends on the geometry or the boundary of the object in a non-trivial way. And in some cases, this geometry dependence can be so strong that even the sign of the Casimir energy can be changed. So in the case of a spherical shell or a high aspect ratio box like this, the Casimir energy, the vacuum fluctuation actually tends to expand the object rather than collapsing it like the case of two parallel plates. So this repulsive, the possibility of generating repulsive Casimir force, is actually has some technological consequence, because if it is possible, then you can potentially reduce frictions. Remember earlier in my talk, I showed you that the device touching and then doesn't come back up again. So there's interest in actually whether it's possible to get a repulsive force. So there are a couple of ways that are under discussion right now. So I've mentioned that for closed geometries like a spherical shell or a box like this, the Casimir force wants to expand the object. But the problem is, if you want to make use of it, once you cut the sphere in half, then this kind of the boundary dependence totally changes, and we don't expect the repulsion to remain. Another possibility is to make one of the surface infinitely permeable, okay, mu equal to infinity. So in this case, the force will become the boundary conditions change, and the force can become repulsive. I think there's not much debate about the validity of the calculation, and the problem is that practically, it is not possible to find a material with an infinite magnetic response, especially at the optical frequency where the Casimir force is dependent on. A third way is to introduce liquid into the gap. Okay, this is actually an experiment that is being done in Capasso's lab. The idea is that you want to achieve a situation where the dielectric function goes in ascending order. Okay, epsilon 1 smaller than epsilon 2, smaller than epsilon 3. So you can see that this situation cannot happen with a vacuum gap, because on a vacuum gap, the 1 in the middle is always 1. You can never create this kind of situation. And finally, recently there's publications on the possible use of metamaterial. And what they find is that if there's an ideal material with a negative refractive index over a broad frequency range, then in fact the Casimir force can become repulsive. The difficulty there is that for real material, the refractive index can only be designed to be negative over a very narrow spectral range. And also, there's a huge amount of loss. So, the fact that the effect only is at a very narrow spectral range means that the effect on the Casimir force is actually minimal. So there are also proposals to actually introduce gain into the medium to compensate for the loss. But in this case, because of the non-equilibrium situation, Lipschitz formula is no longer applies, and I don't think at this point anybody knows what will happen if in fact we have a negative refractive index medium that is optically active. So, excuse me.
Such kind of samples are just also too big.
Yeah, this is very narrow. This is what you're saying.
No, the peak size of the samples which you could do with these meta materials, that would be very difficult to size them down to the relevant nanometer scale.
Well, I'm not sure. As long as their optical property is at the right wavelength range. So people have done this metamaterial up to optical frequencies now.
So spatial extent of them, just to build them, I think one big problem is that they are simply too big. To have them scaled down to a nanoscale, which you have interested in, is probably a challenge.
I see. I think I think you're saying that you can no longer assign a effective medium at this kind of small length scales. I think that might be what you're referring to.
Yes.
Because when you are only separated by
manufacture them, they can manufacture them sufficiently small.
Well, I think those are like can be planar structures. Some of them, right?
Yeah, but the bulk material you need behind is very large, and also the metal distance.
Which part?
Think about these dynamic devices.
Yeah, they're like split rings, for example, like,
yeah.
and you can scale them down.
Which we have to do, they are interesting.
I think what people are thinking about is not the actual metamaterial moving. They are actually replacing one of these surfaces with the metamaterial.
You're saying one part.
Yes.
So this. Rest. The other one is moving.
No, the situation is exactly the same as what we have been discussing, just between two objects, the attractive force between two objects. One of the objects is replaced by an object with negative refractive index.
That was a relation. You work on the imaginary frequency axis.
That's true.
And what happens to the...
This is not clear. This is not clear.
Conservation law someplace. You got to pay for that someplace else.
Right. So it's not clear what is... So these are effects on the real real frequency. And how does it...
Causality tells you have to pay for it someplace else.
So what is the effect on that?
Well, but you know... There are certain constraints on what happens.
Yeah, Kremers-Kronert, yeah.
With the properties that go with it. So I'm completely baffled. When you do that transform in order to calculate your forces, what this so-called negative does? Just as a mathematical operation?
I think that's what people have done. Yeah.
What have they done?
You just plug into... I think it's just putting the Lipschitz formula.
If I do that, I necessarily have a positive monotonically decreasing quantity in Lipschitz's formula. But it's just causality, and there's nothing you can do about that.
I'm not sure whether I know the answer, quite frankly. I think the argument there actually. I think I take it back. I think it might not be the fact that they put in Lipschitz formula. I think they make use of the fact that the negative material can kind of reflect the space somehow.
Oh yeah, I mean it's very nice if you can pick a frequency and start doing
right.
this with your hands.
Right. So in that case the assumption was that the negative material was perfectly negative. Over all frequencies, so you have to pay somewhere else.
What degree of violent causality, but it doesn't work.
Right. So I think that's the most I can comment on that. Yeah, I just want to point out that this is something people are considering right now.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Excuse me, different question. Which way does the box want to get bigger? Is it just the way you've drawn it, or also in the perpendicular?
No, not only in these four directions. Not the other The other two is still attractive.
It's still attractive. Yeah.
Okay, so far all the experimental measurements of the Casimir force involve smooth geometry, such as between a plate and a sphere, or between two plates, or between two spheres. So for this very simple geometry, one do not expect any geometry effects to occur. So the only experiment on these that is not a flat surface is this experiment by Roy and Muhyiddin. They made a sinusoidal corrugation on a surface and then measure the force to a sphere using an atomic force microscope. So they did see a force that exceeds the pairwise additive interaction. But the interpretation of the data is somewhat controversial. For example, Amick, Hank, Kostanian, and Carter has done this calculation on exact geometry, of this geometry, and found that the correction is only large if the distance, the ratio of the distance to the period is large. And in this experiment, the ratio is not large enough to get an appreciable deviation from pairwise additive approximation. And in this paper, it's pointed out that there's a possibility of a lateral force, meaning that imagine that there are some random maximals between these two surfaces which are non-correlated. And as you bring them together, because of the lateral Castanier force, these maximals want to be aligned. And after that is aligned, then the vertical Castanier force becomes larger than it should be. Okay, so that was one of the possibility of what is happening. So what we have done in our lab is that we measured a force on a strongly deformed structure, and we believe that we have some evidence that we see the deviation from pairwise additive approximation. So in this case, we replace one of the flat surfaces by this corrugated surface and make the other surface a sphere. So this is a cross-section of the corrugated structure. So these are grooves that are etched into silicon, and the grooves comes out of the page. So it extends through all the sample in this direction. And we choose this geometry because it's expected to give a very big correction to the pairwise additive approximation. So for the pairwise additive approximation, we can imagine that we make the groove by removing the material. So in the case of the pairwise additive approximation, the force on this corrugated structure will be exactly half of that of the flat surface because half of the material is removed. So by definition, pairwise additive meaning that the pink structure added with the purple structure should give you the overall structure. So each of them should be half. I made the assumption that the distance between the plate is much smaller than the depth of the groove. So this picture is actually not to scale. The groove is much, much deeper. So in this case, the third piece here is so far away that we can neglect the force on it. But the important point is that for the pairwise additive approximation, the force is always half the flat surface, regardless of what the period is. And also, it does not depend on what material the plate is made of. Okay, remember that earlier I described getting the sphere, the force on the sphere from the plate using another approximation called the proximity force approximation. So in that approximation, the plate is the force is assumed to be given by the parallel plate force at each local position. So if we apply the proximity force approximation to our structure, okay, so in this case, sure.
First point, you say the fact that this is one half of the flat one is independent of the wavelength.
Yes, because half the no matter what lambda is, not the wavelength. Lambda is the periodicity, not the wavelength. Lambda is a property of the structure, not the light that is not the mode.
So if you would change the width of the grooves with respect to the walls, then of course you would get a different factor than one half. You have then wide space and say thin walls.
Oh, you change the duty cycle. Then yes, sure.
Yeah.
But
so
for
space in which the width of the walls is equal the width of the grooves.
Right, so this particular case is for the width of the wall, the width of the solid and the width of the empty is the same.
Yeah.
As long as that remains the same, it doesn't matter what the period is.
Yeah, and then you get one half.
I get it right, that's one.
If you change this ratio, then you can...
Then you don't, then you... Obviously, yes, that's right, yes. So this is for the pairwise additive approximation. Another approximation is the proximity force approximation. So in this approximation, we approximate the structure by looking at by assuming that each point it is a parallel plate. So in this structure, there will be two components, the top surface and the bottom surface. And in this case, I'm going to make the same assumption as I did before, that the bottom surface is so far away that it can flow that way. So in this case, only the top surface is remains, right? And again, the force you obtain from this approximation, again, is half of the polar force. Okay? So in both these two approximations, the force is half of the flat surface. In general, they are not the same. I mean, the pairwise additive approximation and the proximity force approximation can give different predictions for other geometries. But for the geometry they have chosen, they are the same. Now, imagine that we take this period, lambda, to zero. The prediction for these two approximations will not change, as we discussed. But the Casimir force can be quite different. So in the case for the Casimir force for perfect metal, that was done by Thorsten Amick in this paper. I'm going to only explain the limiting case where the period is go to zero. Okay. So remember that the Casimir force is related to the electromagnetic mode that is inside the cavity. If the periodicity of this corrugated structure is much smaller than the wavelength of the electromagnetic mode, then the electromagnetic mode will not penetrate the corrugated structure. So in that case, the corrugation behaves as if it is not present. So the force will be identical to the case of a flat surface. So the corrugated is equal to the flat. So in this case, if you look back, this is a factor of two larger than the other two approximations.
Left and right, in and out. So these are sheets. These are purple sheets.
These are.
And the vacuum in between.
Yeah, that's right. Right.
So electric fields cannot exist in and out of the plane of the screen, but electric fields can exist going left and right on top of the purple stuff.
No, actually, electric field cannot exist this way, even if the...
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Right, okay.
Yeah. But I'm asking this way.
This way, right?
Yeah.
This way, if the wavelength is large, then it can. But if the wavelength becomes... if the corrugation period becomes infinitely small, again, the electric field cannot exist.
So it's a distance-dependent answer whether it looks like a metal or not.
But I
only knows that this question, no?
Well, it depends on. You have to compare the separation between observed
and the wavelength.
Yeah, yeah.
It depends
on the distance. Lambda.
But it depends on the distance.
Yeah.
So it's not a general statement.
Well, I'm making the assumption that the lambda goes to zero.
Only in that assumption.
Yeah, lambda is much smaller.
Right. So yeah, in Thorsten's paper, he worked out the entire dependence. I mean, different lambdas at different c's and so on. I'll show that.
It's the lambda of the corrugation, the lambda of the electromagnetic wave.
The lambda of the corrugation.
Right.
That's right.
Basically,
yeah.
You can measure distance in terms of the lambda of the corrugation. Yeah.
So. The point here I just want to make is that the Casimir force can be different from pairwise additive approximation, and I'm only considering a limiting case, right? So, and also this is the reason that I spent so much time factoring in this sample, because I want to get to this regime where the lambda is as small as possible. Okay, so this is the sample. It is actually much more difficult than I thought when I first started fabricating it. It's actually quite a challenge to fabricate such a well-defined structure at the nanoscale. If you just want some deformation on the surface of the silicon, it's actually very easy. I mean, you can get it in a few days. And the problem is that if you want to compare it to theory, you need a very well-defined structure. You have to be able to obtain all the dimensions with very high accuracy. And I think that is the challenging part. And here I just show you how it is made. Essentially, we transfer the pattern into an oxide, silicon oxide etch mask, and then in order to make the trench, we use reactive ion etching to essentially hit the silicon and eat them away. And in order to prevent the mask from being consumed during this etching process, it is actually possible, it is necessary to use deep reactive ion etching where you etch and then passivate the surface sidewall at the same time.
How do you get the debris out of your way?
The what? The debris. Okay, the debris will be mostly organic. And well, there are two kind of debris. One kind of debris is the etch mask, those are oxide. Oxide can be removed by just hydrofluoric acid. And then for the etching, they are organics that are left behind. And then we do an oxygen plasma to essentially burn away the all the remaining.
How do you get this out from the bottom of the cool?
You don't need to. They react and become gas.
Ah, so
it
was
just
gas.
Definitely gas, yeah. So removing organic is not that big of an issue because you can just use some reactive plasma to react with it.
I think you get the idea that it becomes gas-like.
Yeah. Right. So this is actually after we, this picture, for example, is after we clean it up. It wasn't like this when after you do the etching. We also spent a lot of effort in tuning the exposures to get the 50-50 period. But we try to get as close to 50-50 as possible, but the problem is we cannot be exact. Okay? So we have to determine the solid fraction P. In this case, we look at the top view of the structure, like this one, and we do a histogram, like here, of the brightness of each pixel. So by looking at the area of each peak, comparing the area, and we do that for 10 pictures, then we get the solid fraction P to pretty high accuracy. And the depth of the structure is just obtained from this side view here. So even after we complete the fabrication of the structure, you might be surprised that we actually spend as much time characterizing the sample compared to the actual measurement. Those are actually the same amount of time. Okay, so this is the experimental setup. The corrugated surface at the top, and then we have put two spheres, glued two spheres onto the torsional oscillator that I showed you earlier. The groove is aligned so that it is perpendicular to the torsional axis. Okay, we deliberately do so because, remember, in the previous experiments by other groups, the lateral force is a major concern because those can align the maximas and make the force larger than you expect. So in this case, the movable plate is extremely difficult to displace along the y direction. Okay. It is still possible to move the plate sideways in the x direction, but because the stiffness of the spring is much, it's impossible to compress the spring in this direction. So it's very difficult, and we can eliminate the possibility of the lateral Casimir force. To maintain the silicon surface from forming oxide, we use hydrofluoric acid to remove the native oxide immediately before we pump down, and that also creates some hydrogen termination of the surface so that it prevents the oxide, the silicon surface, from oxidation for a short amount of time. And we try to transfer our sample into vacuum before any oxide forms.
Sure, there is no charges due to this oscillation, maybe it's not complete.
I cannot rule that out. So what I did, one of the procedure is to put put some radiation source close to the surface to eliminate any trap charges. But that's the best I can do. I mean, I cannot really rule out that there was charges left behind. The only way I can conclude is look at that, is that any long tail, the electrostatic tail that is present in the force. That's the only way I can know. I cannot rule it out totally. The large distances. And as long as there's no long tail, then I think it's good enough. But I don't think anybody else knows how to totally eliminate the charge, to conclusively say that there's no trap charges.
Okay.
did you dope it as a silicon doped?
But silicon is yes, it's a p-doped silicon. So we try to apply the voltages to avoid depletion of the layer. We want accumulation of carrier rather than depletion. Okay, so just like all the other Casimir force measurements, we need to do the two steps of calibration with the electrostatic force and getting rid of the residual potential. So in this case, for the and again, I forgot to say that we are measuring the resonance frequency at this time instead of measuring the tilt, so to have a higher sensitivity. So for and remember, when we measure the resonance frequency, we get the force gradient rather than the force. So this the red line here is the measured electrostatic grade force gradient, and for a flat surface, the electrostatic force gradient is a very simple form. And the residual voltage is actually rather high. It's almost 0.5 volts because we are measuring between gold and silicon. Now, for the corrugated surface, there is no such nice formula. So what we need to do is to do a numerical calculation based on finite element analysis to solve the 2D Poisson equation. Okay. So we divide, we set up the boundary condition, the voltage difference, and then we divide this volume into about 10,000 triangles and solve the electrostatic energy numerically. We make use of the proximity force approximation because the calculation is done for a flat surface, and in our experiment it's a spherical surface. But because the spherical surface has a very large radius, we can use the proximity force approximation to relate the force to the to energy. So what we calculate is the energy for a flat surface. We also make sure that we have convergence because we can double the number of triangles here, and if we double that, the force only changes by about 0.1%. So we make sure that we have convergence. Okay, so this is the Casimir force gradient measurement between a spherical surface and a flat surface. And the purple dots is the experimental data, and the line is the theory, including both the finite conductivity and the roughness correction. So the finite conductivity correction is based on Lipschitz formula. We just do what everybody does is to look up the optical property of silicon that is tabulated in data books, and also including the roughness correction. And you see that the agreement is reasonable but not exact. There are some deviations up to 5% or so at certain separations. And that is most likely because we don't know the optical property of the silicon, because what we use might be different from the data book. So you might think that it becomes very difficult for us to look at geometry effects because we already see a deviation from material, the finite conductivity of material. And if we add geometry effects, the deviation will be even larger. So it will be very difficult to conclude any geometry effects. So to get around this, I'm actually going to show you a procedure where we compare the ratio between two surfaces of the same material rather than just looking at the force itself. So,
Is that very different from the ideal case if you didn't have roughness and you had infinite conductivity?
I think the ideal case is probably a factor of two or more. In the case of gold, I know it's about a factor of two larger. For silicon, it's probably even less. So,
what about the distance dependence? Does that change much?
I think that doesn't change a whole lot. It's most likely
a scale.
Yeah. Well, actually, I take it back. I mean, I think there's a lot of change here, and then as you go to longer wavelengths, the finite conductivity corrections becomes less important. So that is a change in the distance dependence. Yeah, because dielectric function is a frequency dependent quantity, so you get different corrections at different distance.
So how are you putting in those when you do a calculation? So you're comparing the computation with the gold data and the distance.
No, I.
So Did I misunderstand you?
No, I did not. I did not compare to computation.
I see.
This is measurement, and the other one is computation, based on the data book values.
No, that's what I think. Okay, right. And you're saying that doesn't look like a factor of two wrong. That looks very good. I'm not sure what's going on.
No, the factor of two we're discussing is for perfect metallic surfaces.
Oh, I see. Had you not used the real data?
Right. Have I just used I just used Casimir's formula, for example.
Right.
It would be much higher.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So what I do here is to make three samples like this. Okay. One of them is a flat sample. One of them has is a corrugated sample with period equal to 1. The other one has a period equal to 400 nanometer. All three of them are made from the same silicon wafer, so their optical properties should be identical. And if we go back to remember what I said about the pairwise additive approximation, is that the force on this trench is always half of the force on the flat surface because half of the material is removed. In the experiment, we try to get to be 50-50, to be the width of the solid part to the vacant part is the same. We try to get it the same, but it is not. So we have to multiply it by, instead of 1/2, we will multiply by the solid fraction P. That is the expectation for pairwise additive approximation. And this holds for all lambda and for all material. So any deviation of the measure force from this value will be a effect of the dependence of the Casimir force on geometry.
One question here.
Sure.
When you say pairwise additivity and solid fraction P, I mean P comes into the dielectric function, not the force or the free energy itself. If you have a material composed of two materials, one in the fraction of P, the other one in the fraction of 1 minus P, the composite dielectric function
is
the dielectric function of the first one times 1 minus P and the second one times P.
In this case, it's vacuum.
The Lipschitz formula, and it doesn't come out as P times the interaction energy.
I am not sure whether I understand the question.
The composition is done.
No, but this is a test for the proximity force.
Pairwise additivity, and I'm saying I don't know why would you call this pairwise additive approximation?
But it's a question how you compute this. I mean, so what you do here is you take all pair of atoms you have in the upper and lower surface, and then choose an amplitude for this pairwise.
Hammer approximation.
No. You choose an amplitude to get the right result for two flat surfaces. Right. That's how you gauge the amplitude.
Well,
you sum, and then I think if there's no material, if you vacuum in between these rods, then it's obvious that it must be just.
It seems a little bit strange comparison to me. So I know that if you have a material composed of these flat sheets of some other material,
mm-hmm.
then the dielectric response, of course, in this direction and in this direction will be different. You get a non-isotropic material.
Right.
For non-isotropic materials, composition rules are more complicated. So I'm not sure whether it makes sense to compare with this kind of pairwise additive approximation.
No, I'll show you the data that it doesn't. Sure, but the thing is, I think my point is that so far, all the experiments have been consistent with pairwise additive, because those are very simple geometries, just a flat piece of metal, or a flat piece of flat sphere. I mean, a smooth sphere.
What I would compare with is, of course, a substrate that has non-isotropic properties in this direction. Calculate these non-isotropic epsilons and compare with that.
But this is a different limit. This is just the opposite limit that he's considering. He's considering this approximation material with a very large periodicity. So what is traditionally used. And then you can use the procedure that he has chosen. What you are considering is like the picture below there, like a very short periodicity, where you can sort of consider material with an average of epsilons corresponding to the different materials.
Yeah.
This is the other limit. And actually, this is a valid limit as well. So if one could measure this and this limit for very short periodicities, then it should compare with this procedure. But so there, and then we expect a crossover between these two
between
limits.
Between the two limits, yeah.
Between the two limits. In this curl, but this is the hard case. So one really has to put the geometry into the calculations and somehow solve the problem for non-trivial geometry, which is neither an average of materials nor an average of forces. But your input is valid. It's just the opposite limit for very short periodicities.
So to me, it would be nice to have the experimental data and then both cases to see how that compares with both of them. Because otherwise, if you just talk about
I'm going to show you the comparison to Thorsten's calculation on perfect metals, but with the exact shape of my structure. But let me show you the data.
Let me just point out that these formulas for non-isotropic materials of this type are readily available, and you will be able to just lift them out of the literature.
Okay, so you can just put them into Lipschitz formula.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Okay, so anyway, but what I'm looking for is a deviation from this, the pairwise additive. Okay, whether you think that might be the best thing to plot, we can discuss that. But I'm going to show you the deviation from that. So okay, so this is the most important result. So I show you the force gradient measured from two samples. Okay, one they have different periodicity. And the force gradient for this one is shown in the blue curve here. The force gradient measured for the other one is shown as a red curve, the red dots here. The black line is what you expect from pairwise additive approximation. So that is obtained by actually measuring the force on a flat surface, multiplied it by P, the fraction, okay? So any difference between the data and the line will be a deviation from pairwise additive approximation. So in the bottom here, I plot the same data in a different way. Here, I plot the ratio of the dot to the line. Okay? So if pairwise additive approximation is valid, then we get the constant value of 1. So you can see that my data is consistently higher than the pairwise additive approximation, larger than the error bar. And on the same plot, I also plot the theory by Thorsten. And in that case, it's for perfect metal. So it's not the same as my structure. My structure is a silicon and gold, and the calculation is perfect metal. But at least you can see that there are the few trends that are actually very similar. For example, in both cases, the blue data is lower than the red data, meaning that the corrections to the pairwise additive approximation is stronger for this case compared to this case. Another trend is that the correction becomes larger, both the lines becomes larger as the distance increases. So the corrections becomes larger as for both experiment and theory, right? And the exact values differs by about a factor of 2. So this is most likely due to the fact that our surfaces are not perfect metals; those are silicon and gold. And the interplay of geometry effects and finite conductivity.
Okay. So this factor of 2 you would also roughly, this order of magnitude you would get for two flat surfaces if you compare perfect and realistic.
I don't have it on top of my head. I think it's probably less than 2. I think if I remember right, if it's between gold and gold, it's about 2. But now between gold and silicon, I think it's a little bit less. Yeah. So another thing I want just to be clear of what we are comparing. I am plotting the ratio of the force gradient between a spherical surface and this object. Thorsten's calculation is for the force between two flat surfaces. So actually, I am making use of the proximity force theorem here. I'm converting the force gradient between a spherical surface to this object to the force between a sphere to a flat surface to the other object. So this is, should be valid because the radius of the sphere is very large.
I sort of intuitive understanding why the blue ones are the red ones. Do you have an intuitive understanding of why this effect increases with z, so that at large distances?
Sure. So at the large distances, remember that. Sure. I think at the large distances, the relevant wavelengths here are longer wavelengths. Sorry. The Casimir effect is associated with what is confined, the wavelengths that are confined inside a cavity.
And somehow, if you are far away, you start to resolve this structure.
It becomes, you cannot penetrate because the wavelength is large.
But just that it's the opposite. Why don't we go far away, as you are saying? I mean, you could not resolve. I mean, it looks like your picture, the last picture, with the very fine cuts.
Yeah.
I mean, for large separation.
But, yeah. Is that all right?
It's just the opposite. For large separation, you have small, you have large wavelengths. Yeah.
Yeah, large wavelengths has large, correspond to large wavelengths.
Just look at the limit of very small lambda. I mean, as you said, a very small lambda, you expect this reduced distance and result to hold. And the PFA gets just a factor of 1/2. So that's right. The extreme limit, right?
Okay, it's correct. You should compare to 2.
Lambda zero.
Lambda zero should
be here.
Should be here. Okay, then that's fine. Not to 1/2.
That was something I thought that I've understood. This increase, I'm not yet sure whether I got that one.
No. Also, if you go to larger wavelengths, you go also back to that picture, and you should not compare to the to the proximity force approximation, but to the full picture. I mean, the picture where you have if you show this picture where you have this, to a lower picture.
Yeah, so I mean, I think having is increasing the distance, I think is kind of equivalent to decreasing the wavelength. Decreasing the corrugation period, not the wavelength. Right?
Would help also to understand.
Okay, so I'll just.
It's a very quick question. Are you showing that you're measuring forces which are larger than theory?
Larger than pairwise additive approximation.
Mm-hmm. But in this pairwise additive approximation, you've thrown away everything that was in these holes.
Right.
But your distances are quite large, I think, compared to the depth of.
No, the distance I define somewhat differently from Thorsten. I define the distance as from the top surface. Yeah, Thorsten defined it as to here, to the middle. I define in all my discussion. I define the distance z as to the top surface.
But the way I understand this, the depth of these holes is not as, I mean, not, much, much shorter than what's drawn here, right? These holes are not very deep.
They are very, they are like that.
Z, right? Because your Z was on the order of microns?
No, my Z is on the order of 100 nanometer. 200 to 500 nanometer.
Z is smaller than that.
Yeah, not this one more. Between 0.2, about 0.15 to 0.5. The groove, this depth is 1 micron.
That's one. Okay.
This distance is 1 micron.
Basically, what I wanted to ask is, if you were to add a contribution from what's at the bottom of the holes all the way to the flat surface, this would push up your theory just slightly. And it may.
I'm not sure because I don't resolve anything at 1 micron.
This is very small. to the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, I never...
The proximity force of approximation.
But also the discrepancy is small, right?
Yeah, but it causes a inferred power, right? I mean...
It's tricky.
I wasn't sure about the length.
Yeah, if you look at, essentially, you're worried about this contribution.
That's right.
I'm wondering whether
I don't think I can.
Enough to,
not enough.
This is at 1 micron. I mean, you have to take a blue curve and go to 1 micron. And that's extremely small.
Okay, finally, let me show you some recent theoretical result by Lambrecht. So, Thorsten's calculation is for perfect metal, and recently there's a paper by Astrid Lambrecht on where he included both the geometry effect and the finite conductivity effect. Okay, and so these two plots are the same as the one I showed before, except that I plot the two samples separately. Again, the pairwise additive approximation is this one, the straight line. My data is here. This is Thorsten's result on perfect metal. And this is the theory by Lambrecht. And what he did, I think, is using reflection coefficients and the argument principle. I think you guys probably know it better than I do. So you see that the calculation, again, is doesn't agree totally with my result. It's actually smaller this time. And it's kind of interesting to see that actually my result actually fall between these two limits in both cases. And one possible reason is that the optical constants used in the calculation might be different from what I have, because the optical constants used in the calculation is most likely either some model or from data books, and we can never be sure that it is the actual optical property of our samples. Another interesting thing I found very interesting is here, that the force, when you include material properties, can actually be smaller than pairwise additive approximation. So this never occurs if it is a perfect metal. So in all of Thorsten's calculation, the geometry effects are always push the curve higher than the pairwise additive approximation. And I find it quite interesting here that it can actually be smaller than one.
It's a point where it gets smaller than one, the length scale related to this. Does this length scale correspond to a length scale they have in the material properties? It's very...
I'm not aware of it, though. But you can also extrapolate other curves, right? If this one drops right here, if I further increase the periodicity, it will be somewhere here. And it will occur at a... So I don't know. So there appears that the interplay of finite conductivity and geometry effects is showing some surprising some surprises that we do not yet understand.
You think it could be that you have such big periodicity that you see really the whole at shorter separation, right? I mean, when things...
Can you repeat? I'm not saying I understand.
Well, if you have a sphere,
uh-huh,
and you have a hole in the middle, I mean, when you might see, I mean, not the distance to the peak distance, but the distance, I mean, to the trench.
Uh-huh. So you see that the sphere has some defects in it.
Not the sphere, but I mean, the sphere has a point of closest contact to the plate.
Yes.
And if you have a corrugated plate and you have a large periodicity, I mean, large.
No, I think the calculation.
Not too big radius.
Yeah, the radius is 50. In my case, is 50 micron, and the periodicity here is 400 nanometer. So I don't think that plays a role.
Yeah. But anyway, the pairwise result is perfect metals.
The pairwise result doesn't matter. The pairwise additive, it doesn't depend on material, because you are just removing half of the material.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, so the pairwise is this line.
She's using pairwise in the sense of amount of stuff.
Yeah, just the amount of stuff. You can, yeah, and you.
The same amount of stuff.
Yeah.
The discrepancy with theory is largest when you are most combined.
Why do you? So this is this is data. This
is the smallest error bars. The discrepancy with theory is most pronounced.
Sure. Yeah. So the if you take into account the error bar, then I'm not so certain here experimentally, but I'm quite certain.
Say now on the right hand side, whatever. In both cases, actually. So that means one still has to worry about something. So you cannot blame error bars for discrepancies.
Unless there's some systematic thing, like what I say, the optical constants that we don't know.
But so you don't know what optical model they used for the calculation and how it relates to the data you used?
No, I don't. Yeah. I think I could ask them, yeah. I was assuming that they were using Lipschitz formula and data book values.
So the Langreth paper is just a generalization of the Lipschitz theory to be corrugated and to be trench surface, is that the idea?
I think they used the reflection coefficients. They calculated for the corrugated surface, and then they transformed the integral into transformed the sum of the 0-point energy into an integral along the imaginary frequency axis using the argument
for finite temperature.
No, these are all for zero temperature. These are all for zero temperature.
It doesn't play a role. Let's forget it.
Did they solve Lipschitz's theory for that structure?
I think the material part is contained in the reflection coefficients.
But are they making believe that the rough surface has an effective reflection coefficient? At that averaging level, or they really went and did the work of kind of solving the structure?
I think what they claim is that they sort of really computed for that structure the reflection
coefficients.
Perfectly vertical walls of the slots and so forth.
Right, exactly for that structure. Yeah.
And they fed that into.
You can write the Lipschitz theory in terms of reflection amplitudes. That's very general. And then it applies also to these structures. And then if you plug in the reflection amplitudes in this kind of generalized Lipschitz equation, then you should get the correct answer.
I'm surprised you can calculate the electrodynamic.
Yeah, that also is kind of, I'm not sure what, if they did some approximations. You have to sum over all kind of different modes.
If I understand correctly, both comparisons with theories are for t equals zero.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you only get
play a role only above 1 micron.
Right, and that is what Lamarox and Onofrio are trying to do.
Actually, comparable at 8 micron.
Okay, I think that is all I want to. Actually, one more. This is just work in progress. So the previous structure that I've shown you have very deep grooves, so that as we discussed, that the bottom doesn't contribute. So here I'm actually making some shallow structures like this. So in this case, the bottom surface here will contribute to the total force. And the reason I'm doing this is it is easier to comparison to theory, because perturbation approaches will work to take into account the material properties. And this is a plot I took from Thorsten's paper, where he showed a parameter space that we can vary. So the distance, for example, and the ratio of lambda to the depth. And our previous experiment is actually somewhere way off scale. It's actually somewhere here. And if we can make a structure like this, it will be corresponding to this part of the parameter space. So this is something that is in progress. And I think that's what I want to show you. The summary is, I tell you some general way, procedures in measuring the Casimir force for flat surfaces. I show you the nonlinear Casimir oscillator where we have hysteresis and bistability. And we talk about the geometry dependence of the Casimir force. And my data on these nanoscale trenches is 30% larger compared to pairwise additive approximation. And is a factor of 2 smaller than theories on perfect metals. most likely due to material property issues. And I also thank my collaborators, my students, Yiling Bao and Jay Zhou, who are actually doing the work. And I have a lot of discussions with Thorsten and Andreas, and my funding agency. Okay, thank you.
So I have a little suggestion, if you allow me. To me, your surfaces are a model of an anisotropic dielectric medium.
Okay.
And have a different dielectric property in the direction perpendicular to the plane of your trenches and parallel to it.
Certainly.
So if you take two such surfaces and you rotate them at an angle, you would get a model system where you could measure torques in principle.
That's
yesterday,
true.
Jeremy was telling us how difficult it is to get, you know, substrates that would give measurable torques. And this would be, I think, a very nice alternative to do this kind of experiment.
Do you think this will produce a large enough torque?
Okay, if you take two trench surfaces, you rotate them by an angle, this would be like two dielectrically anisotropic media rotated by the same angle. I know how to calculate the torque.
I mean, it probably will be bigger than the other anisotropic material than you have considered.
Yeah.
But the overall talk, will that be large enough to detect? I don't know.
That's a matter of computation.
Well, no, no.
Unless you can make these trenches in the sphere.
Well, in this case, it will be two sets of trenches, right?
Yeah, but when you have the alignment problem,
right?
You have
so that part of the difficulty remains.
Remains. Nevertheless, you could measure in principle.
I think I agree with you that it's probably much larger, but the experimental maybe even higher. I mean, what you can measure. I don't know how far we are experimentally I don't know whether Jeremy comment on how many orders of magnitude we see.
Well, his problem is to get an appropriate anisotropic dielectric medium, if I understood correctly.
I see.
And you can do that, obviously.
Right. But the question is, how small a torque can he measure? I think that's what I'm trying to bring up. I mean, these structures will, I think it will give you much larger torque than the other structures that you have been considering. But that might not be large enough to be detected. Yeah.
There's a potential problem with this torque because, I mean, it's basically kind of a lateral force, and we know lateral forces decay exponentially with separation. So if you go to large separations,
why do you say that
decays exponentially?
Why do you exponentially? This is a torque. It decays as 1/g³.
I don't think so. No, but there is no torque at very, very small distances because you have proximity force approximation is valid. Right?
I'm not sure.
It seems to me that all this discussion, including the anisotropic dielectric constant, really refers, in a sense, to electromagnetic wavelengths long compared to the geometric variations in the trenching. Because the electromagnetic modes in such a structure are going to be greatly distorted around these sharp edges and so forth. And I'm not sure that any of these calculations are taking that into account. Maybe that's part of the discrepancy between
theory and experiment. Theory has problem with these corners as well? I mean, is that what you're referring to?
We basically decomposed it into Fourier series and then went to so high order. Is that the final answer converged? But the edges are not perfect, they are round off here in the experiment. But they give a substantial contribution that could explain the difference.
So basically, imperfections here could play you.
Really
could
in the sharp edges.
Yeah, I put the sharp edges.
Yeah, please.
It seems that there is a great deal of controversy about what kind of dielectric functions to put into the theory for arbitrary frequencies. So would it be possible to...
I think it's for the thermal effect, right? I think the controversy is
Well, but for instance, Lambrecht's plot did not coincide with your experimental.
Oh, that one. Okay.
And there was a great difference between metallic and the silicon, right? So would it be possible to deposit, say, a very thin layer of gold on top of your wafers and do a control so that you have two metals?
I can deposit gold only on the top surface.
No, is it
all? I can deposit gold only here. I can put gold here, not on the sidewall. Mm-hmm. Also, when I put the gold, it probably a little bit on the bottom. But I think that kind of messes up the.
Because that would sort of kill the material ambiguities that one sees.
But it becomes an even more complicated problem because you have. Even another system and another boundary here.
I thought you could get it everywhere.
No, not everywhere. I can only get it at the top. Okay. All right, thank you very much.